Our speaker today is the Reverend Antonia Wan. Antonia is the Canadian Unitarian Council's Congregational Developmental Staff for the Western Region and British Columbia. That's a lot of territory to cover, from Thunder Bay in the east to Vancouver Island in the west. Antonia is a third-generation Canadian Unitarian. She grew up near Montreal, Mont-Saint-Hilaire, I know where that is, and is a longtime Vancouverite. She studied at the Vancouver School of Theology and trained at the Peter Lougheed Medical Center in Calgary, and has a professional background in planning and leading design teams. Prior to her work with the CUC, Antonia worked with churches and fellowships large and small in New Mexico, Montana, and British Columbia. She has two young adult children and a partner who shares her love of the outdoors and taught her to sail. Antonia writes, "I believe in the power of Unitarian Universalist congregations to heal spirits and change the world. Fostering the vitality of Canadian congregations at this time in history, in the broad sense, as well as in our own tradition, is an honor for me. And here's to widening circles of community, compassion, and courage." Antonia?
Good morning. Thank you, Wayne. I'm going to start with a reading, so I invite you to turn inwards, close your eyes if you wish. Brother David Steindl-Rast reminds us that the Chinese word for busy is composed of two characters, heart and killing. When we make ourselves so busy that we are always rushing around trying to get this or that done or over with, we kill something vital in ourselves and we smother the quiet wisdom of our heart. When we invest our work with judgment and impatience, always striving for speed and efficiency, we lose the capacity to appreciate the million quiet moments that may bring us peace, beauty, or joy. As we seek salvation through our frantic productivity and accomplishments, we squander the teachings that may be present in this very moment, in the richness of this particular breath. In the book of Ecclesiastes, there is a proverb, "Better one hand full of quiet than two hands full of striving after wind." Unpracticed in the art of quiet, we hope to find our safety, our belonging, and our healing by increasing our levels of accomplishment. But our frantic busyness actually makes us deaf to what is healing and sacred, both in ourselves and in one another. Words by Wayne Muller. In a land not so far away, in a time not so long ago, two lovers were quarreling regularly. They were in a repeating cycle where, on one hand, one of them was being extraordinarily difficult, arrogant, illogical. And on the other hand, I was making complete sense, as I always do. How could he see the other way around was beyond me? We weren't even agreeing to disagree. Chris's facts and logic didn't fit my definition of facts and logic, nor mine his. And I confess, Jesus' parable of admonishing the disciples for seeing the sliver in another's eye and not examining the log in one's own eye ran through my mind repeatedly. It sure looked to me like the sliver in Chris's eye was a log, but I couldn't make him see the error of his views. This is a late-in-life relationship, just a few years old. As a mature adult with the benefit of several decades of life experience, past mistakes and humiliations, I've been fascinated by the journey of our growing love and trust, and what happens when we bump up against the things we don't like or don't understand in one another. Why can't he say sorry? Why does she always think she makes sense? In spite of the wisdom of our years, we still expect one another to see things the same way, to argue the same kind of logic, to hold the same kinds of values, as people say in our congregations, to be like-minded, which we are until we aren't. After numerous rounds of testy dialogue and a failure to find what I saw as common sense, I eventually learned to stop short of spontaneous combustion. I learned to accept the mysterious gap between us and smile to reassure my partner that while we weren't on the same page always, I loved him still, as he clearly loved me. But it got me wondering about why we don't understand one another when it seems we should, why adults sometimes can't reach reasonable common ground, why the idea of a perfect world makes us laugh. I confess that I expect to understand things. I grew up in a family that taught me if one did things the right way and made the right choices, life would basically unfold the way it should, at least mostly. My family was Unitarian and highly educated and British. A family in which life was to be honored by worthy endeavors. A good life to be achieved by the pursuit of the optimal quality of intellectual, spiritual, physical, and material being, with a priority on the intellectual. I think my family's view reflected the Unitarian understanding of a good life as it came down through the last few hundred years, in which the proper of a good life have much to do with progress, as in the improvement of society through education, self-development, and achievement. These ideals focus on the potential of an individual, and they are good and worthy. Ideals reflected in our first principle of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. For instance, many of us seek to make sure our children have certain privileges to foster these properties of a good life. education, nutrition, love, security, and opportunities to grow in their self-confidence. Seeking a good life by pursuing optimal qualities is known in ethical circles as perfectionism. Perfectionism is a moral theory that postulates that there is a thing called a good life, that there is such a thing as an intrinsically desirable life, and it characterizes this life in a distinctive way. It says that certain properties constitute human nature or are definitive of humanity. They make humans human. The good life develops these properties to a high degree or realizes what is central to human nature. Different versions of the theory may disagree about what the relevant properties are, and so disagree about the content of the good life, but they share the foundational idea that what is good ultimately is the development of human nature. In broad terms, a good life was a well-rounded life. In my family, a good life also required the development of an expertise born of one's passion and of some inherent social worth. However, I discovered that social worth in my family didn't include art, or at least my art, which was my passion. Instead, I was packed off to school to study calculus, chemistry, and physics, subjects that I can credit with providing my greatest experiences of mystery and incomprehension. Who defines the right assortment of values or properties, and who judges whether I'm living the way I'm supposed to? Where do I belong if I don't meet these standards of a good life, or if I don't place value on striving for the good life? What if I fail to meet your expectations? These questions are part of the process of growing up. But how does the good life account for the fact that life is messy, full of misunderstandings, mistakes, and mystery and misery? What about the reality that success in the pursuit of a good life itself can lead to entitlement and arrogance on one hand, if it's not tempered by loss, sacrifice, or compromise born of one's love for one's community? And speaking of failure, my forced foray into calculus and chemistry and physics? Not so good. Utter failure, in fact. I took a year off from school to regroup. My parents were silent on the matter, which I thought was appropriate, since they failed to listen to me in the first place and put me in the sciences. Eventually, they spoke up, and they said to me, "What about secretarial school?" I have great respect for executive assistants, but I am no more an executive assistant than I am a chemist. And neither of these would have been good lives for me. My parents meant well, but the lenses through which they saw life limited their visions of what I could be. They couldn't see the way I did. Their ideals were too fixed to accommodate me. I gave up any hope of their understanding, and they finally let go of trying to figure me out, but pledged their support of me nonetheless. I took my creative spirit off to design school. I became a theme park planner, working with designers and art directors on huge and perhaps socially irrelevant projects of questionable intellectual value that nonetheless give a lot of people a lot of pleasure. Now I'm a minister, a UU minister. So far, it's been a good life. My path made no rational sense to my parents, but they finally realized that their theories of what was good for me and their beliefs of what I was supposed to be weren't working, and they gracefully stayed at my back as I stumbled forward. For the first time, they relied on faith as parents, letting go of their attempts to tell me what was right for me. Figuring out how to relate to one another in our families, in our workplaces, our communities, and our congregations can be frustrating. If you have children, you may have learned that what works really well with one kid is totally useless with the other kid. If you've worked on the board of your church, you may have discovered sides of other people that surprised you. You may have learned that pushing your way past the present difficulty and on with the task at hand sometimes lands you in a bigger mess than you started with. Perhaps some of you have heard the voice in your head saying things like, "But I thought it was clear we were going to do such and such." How could anybody see things that way? We don't need to talk about this. It's obvious what needs to be done. I understand his point of view, and it's not changing my mind. Or maybe I'm the only one this has happened to. Even raised as a Unitarian with all the talk of accepting diverse views, even with my own experience of being incongruent with my parents' expectations, I still expected people to be like me, to have the same kinds of values as me. The apple, as they say, doesn't fall far from the tree. I don't blame this on Unitarian Universalism, and yet I find my own arrogances and assumptions reflected in writings such as this one by Vivian Pomeroy, a Unitarian Christian. Forgive us that we often forgive ourselves so easily and others so hardly. Forgive us that we expect perfection from those to whom we show none. Forgive us for repelling people by the way we set a good example. Forgive us the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that we should use our little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that we should feel superior to others when we are only more shielded. And may we encourage the secret struggle of every person. I found this prayer in our hymnal, in a tiny section called Confessions. Confession is a Catholic sacramental tradition intended to heal the soul and regain the grace of God when one has sinned, a practice understood to form conscience and foster peace within. Now a confession of my own. This term and many others meant nothing to me before going to seminary, and I sympathize with those of you who feel a negative reaction to them. And yet, as I read Vivian Pomeroy's words, I see a reflection of myself, of the presumptions of my culture, of where some of my blind spots may lie, and what my expectations of how things and people should be. And I'm humbled. I'm humbled, and I'm reminded of lessons I learned thanks to the Unitarian Universalist Association in the U.S. In the 1990s, the UUA recognized that in spite of our liberal ideals of diversity, Unitarian congregations were so white, so middle class, so educated, and so entitled as to be oppressively conformist. To challenge the status quo and lead by example, the UUA undertook a critical self-examination. It was a painful and awkward process, but the leadership persevered in uncovering and challenging unwritten norms and expectations that perpetuated patterns of privilege, especially racial privilege, however unintended. As part of this ongoing initiative, I was forced to take an anti-racism program during my ministerial training. Being righteously Canadian and married to an Asian for 17 years, I was indignant, but I had to go. I resisted and protested, but like a child forced to sit in a chair and listen, eventually I heard things I hadn't understood about the subtle and insidious nature of our cultural expectations and prejudices that marginalize people who are different. My reality changed. My heart changed. My understanding of a good life changed. I learned to be much more suspect of the familiar and the comfortable, much less suspicious of the strange and the different. I learned that I don't always recognize how my habits and expectations may in fact be offensive to another. I learned that to be a Unitarian Universalist means to turn the mirror of careful reflection on myself and examine how my biases might be marginalizing someone and affecting the spiritual community around me. I learned to stay present in the confusion of not understanding, to keep listening in faith that understanding would eventually come. Forgive me that I often forgive myself so easily and others so hardly. Forgive me that I expect perfection from those to whom I show none. Forgive me for repelling people by the way I set a good example. Forgive me the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that I should use my little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that I should feel superior to others when I am only more shielded. And may I encourage the secret struggle of every person. Three years ago, I was in Minneapolis at the UUA's annual General Assembly. At the time, Arizona had resorted to aggressive policing and oppressive laws to deal with the impact of a huge number of undocumented immigrants from Mexico. In the business meeting, the assembly of thousands of UUs was faced with a difficult decision of whether or not to proceed with plans to hold the 2012 General Assembly in Phoenix. A large non-refundable deposit had been made. There were two positions: to carry on and go to Phoenix to show solidarity with the oppressed, or to take a stand by boycotting Arizona. And strong convictions reigned on each side. Each was committed to important values. Even with the best of intentions behind each position, it was anticipated to reach an impasse and to end in an unpleasant showdown. The debate went around in circles, each party respecting the other's concerns while holding their own valid positions. Agreeing to disagree wasn't an option. Many boycott supporters were people of color who feared going to Phoenix and felt it unfair for them to miss the conference. A majority vote wouldn't suffice. Finally, the two groups agreed to retreat together and see if the gap between them could be closed. Thanks to a deep commitment to staying involved in communicating through deep emotions and worthy convictions, a plan emerged. A plan that honored the need to resist injustice as well as the need to respect vulnerability. A plan not to hold a business as usual assembly complete with conference center and fancy hotels, but rather one focused squarely on social justice, in which Unitarian Universalists would be in the community learning the plight of the immigrants and giving a hand. What magic happened in the meeting of the two groups was that people spoke and listened in a spirit of mutuality. They risked being wrong and losing the argument because each trusted the other not to hurt, not to judge, not to deny or dismiss or enlighten or fix. Each trusted the other to listen with open ears and open hearts. They risked exploring new territory together, despite their differences, and they found ground they could stand on together. The rest of us were happy to stand with them. I never imagined I would ever say that an annual business meeting was a deeply spiritual experience, but it was, and I can. As 4,000 of us voted and affirmed our commitment to this plan, a chant of "Si se puede" started in one corner of the floor and swept across the room, roughly translated to "Yes, we can" in Spanish. It was a prairie boy that started that, Neil Anderson. Some of you may know him. The enduring message of our faith is that life is a gift, one that we must nurture and serve so that all might find love and peace. That there is no theological basis for limiting your joyful experience of the life divine within you, however and whenever you have it. We gather to say yes to the spirit within me and the spirit within you, and to ask the question, what shall we now do together to share it? There's another message of our faith that says, we are what we create together. We are called to building love and compassion, to bring people into a loving, life-giving, transformational relationship with the spirit of life, with one another, and with the world. We cannot change the world except by changing ourselves. And so how we deal with things that perplex us or divide us, how we reflect on our words and actions, how we receive ideas or people that are strange to us, how we treat someone with very different values than our own, these are all part of our spiritual practice as Unitarians, no matter where we are. We are what we create together. This is how we're supposed to live. In the midst of these confusing times, what will that be? Will we go around in circles defending our positions and our rights? Or will we take a risk, lay down our ideals, and break open our hearts to the unknown? The choices are ours. And my partner and I, we're better at negotiating the gaps in our understanding and talking things through. At some point, something broke open. A threshold was crossed where fears and expectations were dissolved and trust came in their place. I've stopped trying to make sense of things. Thoughts of logs and slivers no longer swim through my mind. And we both occasionally say sorry. Is it perfect? Hardly. Is it how we're supposed to live? I think so. And this is precious. This is sacred. and it is in every intrinsic and perfect way enough. I close with words from Unitarian poet and friend Janet Vickers, titled Love, The Initiation. Broken, not in, but open. The needled air unthreads the thread, the fabric you've worn all your life. Fire travels through your addictions, no longer fighting among themselves. Should, want, would, all done. Control is not what you have. What you have is panic, rapture, as you watch your own disembowelment. It's not his fault or yours. It's your compass that breaks. The mind's borders invaded by a nameless galaxy. And suddenly, briefly, you hold in your arms every planet that ever named itself or was named, and your eyes swallow the sky. Whole. May it ever be so.